Bridge. Something interesting. She inclined her head in a bow, but didn't want to embarrass herself with another poor curtsy. I think so, she replied. I was just wondering how many tons of metal we're standing on, hoping it will keep us up. The prince let out a puff of laughter, tinged with nervous. He shifted his feet, as if suddenly realizing exactly how high above the water they were. I'll do my best to keep that thought out of my head, he mumbled. Any other frightening notions to share? How much time do you have? She said with half a grin. Half only, because something tugged at the rest, weighing it down. The cage of the capital was not a happy place for Corianne. Nor Tiberius Calor.
Would you favor me with a walk? He asked, extending an arm.
This time, Corianne saw no hesitation in him, or even the pensive wonderings of a question. He knew her answer already. Of course, and she slipped her arm in his. This will be the last time I hold the arm of a prince, she thought as they walked the bridge. She thought that every time, and she was always wrong. In early June, a week before the court would flee Archaon for the smaller but just as grand summer palace, Tybe brought someone to meet her. They were to rendezvous in East Archaon, in the sculpture garden outside the Hexaprene Theater. Corianne was early, for Jessamine started drinking during breakfast, and she was eager to get away. For once, her relative poverty was an advantage. Her clothes were ordinary, clearly silver, as they were striped in her house colors of gold and yellow, but nothing remarkable. No gems to denote her as a lady of a high house, as someone worth noticing. Not even a servant in uniform to stand a few paces behind. The other silvers floating through the collection of carved marble barely saw her, and for once, she liked it that way. The green dome of Hexaprene rose above, shading her from the still-rising sun. A black swan of smooth, flawless granite perched at the top, its long neck arched and wings spread wide, every feather meticulously sculpted. A beautiful monument to silver excess. And probably red maid, she knew, glancing around. There were no reds nearby, but they bustled on the street. A few stopped to glance at the theater, their eyes raised to a place they could never inhabit. Perhaps I'll bring Eliza and Melanie some day. She wondered if the maids would like that, or be embarrassed by such charity. She never found out. Tybe's arrival erased all thoughts of her red servants, and most other things along with them. He had none of his father's beauty, but was handsome in his own way. Tybe had a strong jaw, still stubbornly trying to grow a beard, with expressive golden eyes and a mischievous smile. His cheeks flushed when he drank, and his laughter intensified, as did his rippling heat, but at the moment he was sober as a judge and twitchy. Nervous, Corianne realized as she moved to meet him and his entourage. Today he was dressed plainly, but not as poorly as me. No uniform, medals, nothing official to denote this a royal event. He wore a simple coat, charcoal gray, over a white shirt, dark red trousers, and black boots polished to a mirror shine. The sentinels were not so informal. Their masks and flaming robes were mark enough of his birthright.
Good morning, he said,
and she noticed his fingers drumming rapidly at his side.
I thought we could see Fall of Winter. It's new from Piedmont.
Her heart leapt at the prospect. The theater was an extravagance her family could hardly afford, and, judging by the glint in Tybe's eye, he knew that. Of course, that sounds wonderful.
Good, he replied,
hooking her arm in his own. It was second nature to both of them now, but still Corianne's arm buzzed with the feel of him. She had long decided theirs was only a friendship. He's a prince, bound to Queen's Trial, though she could still enjoy his presence. They left the garden, heading for the tiled steps of the theater and the fountained plaza before the entrance. Most stopped to give them room, watching as their prince and a noble lady crossed to the theater. A few snapped photographs,
the bright lights blinding Corianne, but Tybe smiled through it. He was used to this sort of thing. She didn't mind it either, not truly. In fact, she wondered whether or not there was a way to dim the camera bulbs and prevent them from stunning anyone who came near. The thought of bulbs and wire and shaded glass occupied her until Tybe spoke.
"Robert will be joining us, by the way," he blurted as they crossed the threshold, stepping over a mosaic of black swans taking flight.
At first, Corianne barely heard him, stunned as she was by the beauty of Hexaprin, with its marbled walls, soaring staircases, explosions of flowers, and mirrored ceiling hung with a dozen gilded chandeliers. But after a second, she clamped her jaw shut and turned back to Tybe to find him blushing furiously, worse than she had ever seen. She blinked at him, concerned. In her mind's eye, she saw the king's paramour, the prince who was not royal.
"That's quite all right with me," she said, careful to keep her voice low.
There was a crowd forming, eager to enter the matinee performance.
"Unless it isn't all right with you."
"No, no, I'm very happy he came. I asked him to come."
Somehow the prince was tripping over his words, and Corianne could not understand why.
"I wanted him to meet you."
"Oh," she said, not knowing what else to say. Then she glanced down at her dress, ordinary, out of style, and frowned. "I wish I wore something else. It's not every day you meet a prince," she added with the shadow of a wink. He barked a laugh of humor and relief.
"Clever, Corianne, very clever."
They bypassed the ticket booths, as well as the public entrance to the theater. Tybe led her up one of the winding staircases, offering her a better view of the massive foyer. As on the bridge, she wondered who made this place, but deep down she knew. Red labor, red craftsmen, with perhaps a few magnetrons to aid the process. There was the usual twinge of disbelief. How could servants create such beauty and still be considered inferior? They are capable of wonders different from our own. They gain skill through handiwork and practice, rather than birth. Is that not equal to silver strength, if not greater than it? But she did not dwell on such thoughts long. She never did. This is the way of the world. The royal box was at the end of a long, carpeted hall decorated by paintings. Many were of Prince Robert and Queen Annabel, both great patrons of the arts in the capital. Tybe pointed them out with pride, lingering by a portrait of Robert and his mother in full regalia.
"Annabel hates that painting," a voice said from the end of the hall.
Like his laugh, Prince Robert's voice had a melody to it, and Corianne wondered if he had singer blood in his family. The prince approached, gliding silently across the carpet with long, elegant strides. A silk, Corianne knew, remembering he was of House Erol. His ability was agility, balance, lending him swift movement and acrobat-like skill. His long hair fell over one shoulder, gleaming in dark waves of blue-black. As he closed the distance between them, Corianne noticed gray at his temples, as well as laugh lines around his mouth and eyes.
"She doesn't think it a true likeness of us. Too pretty, you know your mother,"
Robert continued, coming to stop in front of the painting. He gestured to Annabel's face and then his own. Both seemed to glow with youth and vitality, their features beautiful and eyes bright.
"But I think it's just fine. After all, who doesn't need a little help now and then?"
he added with a kind wink.
"You'll find that soon enough, Tybe."
"Not if I can help it,"
Tybe replied.
"Sitting for paintings might be the most boring act in the kingdom."
Corianne angled a glance at him. "A small price to pay, though, for a crown."
"Well said, Lady Jacos, well said," Robert laughed, tossing back his hair. "Step lightly around this one, my boy, though it seems you've already forgotten your manners."
Of course,"
Tybe said, and waved his hand, gesturing for Corianne to come closer.
"Uncle Robert, this is Corianne of House Jacos, daughter of Lord Harris, governor of Adirondack. And Corianne, this is Prince Robert of House Erol.
sworn consort of His Royal Majesty, King Tiberius V. Her curtsy had improved in the past months, but not by much. Still, she attempted, only to have Robert pull her into an embrace. He smelled of lavender and baked bread?
"A pleasure to finally meet you," he said, holding her at arm's length.
For once, Corianne did not feel as if she was being examined. There didn't seem to be an unkind bone in Robert's body, and he smiled warmly at her.
"Come now. They should be starting momentarily."
As Tybe did before, Robert took her arm, patting her hand like a doting grandfather.
"You must sit by me, of course."
Something tightened in Corianne's chest, an unfamiliar sensation. Was it happiness? She thought so. Grinning as widely as she could, she looked over her shoulder to see Tybe following, his eyes on hers, his smile both joyous and relieved. The next day, Tybe left with his father to review troops at a fort in Delphi, leaving Corianne free to visit Sarah. House Skonos had an opulent townhouse on the slopes of West Archeon, but they also enjoyed apartments in Whitefire Palace itself, should the royal family have need of a skilled skin healer at any moment. Sarah met her at the gates, unaccompanied, her smile perfect for the guards, but a warning to Corianne.
"What's wrong? What is it?"
she whispered as soon as they reached the gardens outside the Skonos chambers.
Sarah drew them farther into the trees, until they were inches from an ivy-draped garden wall, with immense rose bushes on either side, obstructing them both from view. A thrum of panic went through Corianne.
Has something happened? To Sarah's parents? Was Julian wrong? Would Sarah leave them for the war?
Corianne selfishly hoped that was not the case. She loved Sarah as well as Julian did, but was not so willing to see her go, even for her own aspirations. Already the thought filled her with dread, and she felt tears prick her eyes.
"Sarah, are you going to—" she began, stammering.
But Sarah waved her off.
"Oh, Cory, this has nothing to do with me. Don't you dare cry," she added, forcing a small laugh while she hugged Corianne. "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. I just didn't want to be overheard."
Relief flooded through Corianne.
"Thank my colors," she mumbled.
"So what requires such secrecy? Is your grandmother asking you to lift her eyebrows again?"
"I certainly hope not."
"Then what?"
"You met Prince Robert."
Corianne scoffed.
"And? This is court. Everyone's met Robert. Everyone knows him, but they don't have private audiences with the king's paramour. In fact, he is not at all well-liked."
"Can't imagine why. He's probably the kindest person here."
"Jealousy, mostly. And a few of the more traditional houses think it's wrong to elevate him so high. Crowned prostitute is the term most used, I think."
Corianne flushed, both with anger and embarrassment on Robert's behalf.
"Well, if it's a scandal to meet him and like him, I don't mind in the least. Neither did Jessamine, actually. She was quite excited when I explained."
"Because Robert isn't the scandal, Corianne." Sarah took her hands, and Corianne felt a bit of her friend's ability seep into her skin. A cool touch that meant her paper cut from yesterday would be gone in a blink.
"It's you and the Crown Prince, your closeness. Everyone knows how tightly knit the royal family is, particularly where Robert is concerned. They value him and protect him above everything. If Tiberius wanted you two to meet, then—"
Despite the pleasant sensation, Corianne dropped Sarah's hands.
"We're friends. That's all this ever can be."
She forced a giggle that was quite unlike herself.
"You can't seriously think Tybe sees me as anything more, that he wants or even can want anything more from me."
She expected her friend to laugh with her, to wave it all off as a joke. Instead, Sarah had never looked so grave.
"All signs point to yes, Corianne." "Well, you're wrong. I'm not. He wouldn't. And besides, there's Queen's trial to think of. It must be soon. He's of age, and no one would ever choose me."
Again, Sarah took Corianne's hands and gave them a gentle squeeze.
I think he would.
Don't say that to me, Corianne whispered. She looked to the roses, but it was Tybe's face she saw. It was familiar now, after months of friendship. She knew his nose, his lips, his jaw, his eyes most of all. They stirred something in her, a connection she did not know she could make with another person. She saw herself in them, her own pain, her own joy. We are the same, she thought, searching for something to keep us anchored, both alone in a crowded room.
It's impossible, and telling me this, giving me any kind of hope where he is concerned,
she sighed and bit her lip.
I don't need that heartache along with everything else. He's my friend, and I'm his. Nothing more.
Sarah was not one for fancies or daydreaming. She cared more for mending broken bones than broken hearts. So Corianne could not help but believe her when she spoke, even against her own misgivings.
Friend or not, Tybe favors you. And for that alone you must be careful. He's just painted a target on your back, and every girl at court knows it.
Every girl at court hardly knows who I am, Sarah. But still, she returned home vigilant. And that night, she dreamed of knives in silk, cutting her apart.
There would be no queen's trial. 2 months passed at the Hall of the Sun, and with every dawn the court waited for some announcement. Lords and ladies pestered the king, asking when his son would choose a bride from their daughters. He was not moved by anyone's petition, meeting all with his beautiful, stoic eyes. Queen Annabel was quite the same, giving no indication as to when her son would undertake his most important duty. Only Prince Robert had the boldness to smile, knowing precisely what storm gathered on the horizon. The whispers rose as days passed. They wondered if Tiberius was like his father, preferring men to women, but even then, he was bound to choose a queen to bear him sons of his own. Others were more astute, picking up the trail of carefully laid breadcrumbs Robert had left for them. They were meant to be gentle, helpful signposts. The prince has made his choice clear, and no arena will change his mind. Corianne Jacos dined with Robert regularly, as well as Queen Annabel. Both were quick to praise the young girl, so much so that the gossips wondered if House Jacos was as weak as they appeared.
A trick, they said. A poor mask to hide a powerful face?
The cynics among them found other explanations.
She's a singer, a manipulator. She looked into the prince's eyes and made him love her. It would not be the first time someone broke our laws for a crown.
Lord Harris reveled in the newfound attention. He used it as leverage, to trade on his daughter's future for Tetrarch coins and credit. But he was a poor player in a large, complicated game. He lost as much as he borrowed, betting on cards as well as treasury stocks, or undertaking ill-thought, costly ventures to improve his governed region. He founded 2 mines at the behest of Lord Samos, who assured him of rich iron veins in the Adirondack Hills. Both failed within weeks, turning up nothing but dirt. Only Julian was privy to such failures, and he was careful to keep them from his sister. Tybe, Robert, and Annabel did the same, shielding her from the worst gossip, working in conjunction with Julian and Sarah to keep Corianne blissful in her ignorance. But, of course, Corianne heard all things, even through their protections, and to keep her family and friends from worry, to keep them happy, she pretended to be the same. Only her diary knew the cost of such lies.
Father will bury us with both hands. He boasts of me to his so-called friends, telling them I'm the next queen of this kingdom. I don't think he's ever paid so much attention to me before, and even now it is minuscule, not for my own benefit. He pretends to love me now because of another, because of Tybe. Only when someone else sees worth in me does he condescend to do the same.
Because of her father, she dreamed of a queen's trial she did not win, of being cast aside and returned to the old estate. Once there, she was made to sleep in the family tomb,
beside the still, bare body of her uncle. When the corpse twitched, hands reaching for her throat, she would wake, drenched in sweat, unable to sleep for the rest of the night. "Julian and Sarah think me weak, fragile, a porcelain doll who will shatter if touched," she wrote. "Worst of all, I'm beginning to believe them. Am I really so frail, so useless? Surely I can be of some help somehow, if Julian would only ask. Are Jessamine's lessons the best I can do? What am I becoming in this place? I doubt I even remember how to replace a light bulb. I am not someone I recognize. Is this what growing up means?" Because of Julian, she dreamed of being in a beautiful room, but every door was locked, every window shut, with nothing and no one to keep her company, not even books, nothing to upset her. And always, the room would become a birdcage with gilded bars. It would shrink and shrink until it cut her skin, waking her up. "I am not the monster the gossips think me to be. I've done nothing, manipulated no one. I haven't even attempted to use my ability in months, since Julian has no more time to teach me. But they don't believe that. I see how they look at me, even the whispers of House Mirandus, even Alara. I have not heard her in my head since the banquet, when her sneers drove me to Tybe. Perhaps that taught her better than to meddle. Or maybe she is afraid of looking into my eyes and hearing my voice, as if I'm some kind of match for her razored whispers. I am not, of course. I am hopelessly undefended against people like her. Perhaps I should thank whoever started the rumor. It keeps predators like her from making me prey." Because of Alara, she dreamed of ice-blue eyes following her every move, watching as she donned a crown. People bowed under her gaze and sneered when she turned away, plotting against their newly made queen. They feared her and hated her in equal measure, each one a wolf waiting for her to be revealed as a lamb. She sang in the dream, a wordless song that did nothing but double their bloodlust. Sometimes they killed her, sometimes they ignored her, sometimes they put her in a cell. All three wrenched her from sleep. "Today Tybe said he loves me, that he wants to marry me. I do not believe him. Why would he want such a thing? I am no one of consequence, no great beauty or intellect, no strength or power to aid his reign. I bring nothing to him but worry and weight. He needs someone strong at his side, a person who laughs at the gossips and overcomes her own doubts. Tybe is as weak as I am, a lonely boy without a path of his own. I will only make things worse. I will only bring him pain. How can I do that?" Because of Tybe, she dreamed of leaving court for good, like Julian wanted to do, to keep Sarah from staying behind. The locations varied with the changing nights. She ran to Delphi or Harbor Bay or Piedmont or even the Lakelands, each one painted in shades of black and gray. Shadow cities to swallow her up and hide her from the prince and the crown he offered. But they frightened her too, and they were always empty, even of ghosts. In these dreams, she ended up alone. From these dreams, she woke quietly, in the morning, with dried tears and an aching heart. Still, she did not have the strength to tell him no. When Tiberius Calore, heir to the throne of Norda, sank to a knee with a ring in hand, she took it. She smiled. She kissed him. She said yes.
"You have made me happier than I ever thought I could be,"
Tybe told her. "I know the feeling," she replied, meaning every word. She was happy, yes, in her own way, as best she knew. But there is a difference between a single candle in darkness and a sunrise. There was opposition among the high houses. Queen's Trial was their right, after all, to wed the most noble son to the most talented daughter. House Mirandus, Samos, Osanos were once the front-runners, their girls groomed to be queens, only to have even the chance of a crown snatched away by some nobody. But the king stood firm, and there was precedent. At least two Calore kings before had wed outside the bonds of Queen's Trial. Tybe would be the third. As if to apologize for the Queen's trial slight, the rest of the wedding was rigidly traditional. They waited until Corianne turned 16 the following spring, drawing out the engagement, allowing the royal family to convince, threaten, and buy their way to the acceptance of the high houses. Eventually all agreed to the terms. Corianne Jacos would be queen, but her children, all of them, would be subject to political weddings. A bargain she did not want to make, but Tybe was willing, and she could not tell him no. Of course, Jessamine took credit for everything. Even as Corianne was laced into her wedding gown, an hour from marrying a prince, the old cousin crowed across a brimful glass.
"Look at your bearing. Those are Jaco's bones. Slender, graceful, like a bird."
Corianne felt nothing of the sort. If I was a bird, then I could fly away with Tybe. The tiara on her head, the first of many, poked into her scalp. Not a good omen. "It gets easier," Queen Annabel whispered into her ear. Corianne wanted to believe her. With no mother of her own, Corianne had willingly accepted Annabel and Robert as substitute parents. In a perfect world, Robert would even walk her down the aisle instead of her father, who was still wretched. As a wedding gift, Harris had asked for 5,000 tetrarchs in allowance. He didn't seem to understand that presents were usually given to the bride, not requested of her. Despite her soon-to-be royal position, he had lost his governorship to poor management. Already on thin ice, due to Tybe's unorthodox engagement, the royals could do nothing to help, and House Provost gleefully took up the governance of Adirondack. After the ceremony, the banquet, and even after Tybe had fallen asleep in their new bedchamber, Corianne scrawled in her diary. The penmanship was hasty, slurred, with sloping letters and blots of ink that bled through the pages. She did not write often anymore. "I am married to a prince who will one day be a king. Usually this is where the fairy tale ends. Stories don't go much further than this moment, and I fear there's a good reason for it. A sense of dread hung over today, a black cloud I still can't be rid of. It is an unease deep in the heart of me, feeding off my strength. Or perhaps I am coming down with sickness. It's entirely possible. Sarah will know. I keep dreaming of her eyes, Alara's. Is it possible? Could she be sending me these nightmares? Can whispers do such a thing? I must know. I must. I must. I must." For her first act as a princess of Norda, Corianne employed a proper tutor, as well as taking Julian into her household, both to hone her ability and help her defend against what she called annoyances, a carefully chosen word. Once more she elected to keep her problems to herself, to stop her brother from worry, as well as her new husband. Both were distracted, Julian by Sarah, and Tybe by another well-guarded secret. The king was sick. It took 2 long years before the court knew anything was amiss. "It's been like this for some time now," Robert said, one hand in Corianne's. She stood on a balcony with him, her face the picture of sorrow. The prince was still handsome, still smiling, but his vigor was gone, his skin gray and dark, leached of life. He seemed to be dying with the king. But Robert's was an ailment of the heart, not the bones and blood, as the healers said of the king's ills. A cancer, a gnawing, riddling Tiberius with rot and tumors. He shivered, despite the sun above, not to mention the hot summer air. Corianne felt sweat on the back of her neck, but like Robert, she was cold inside. "The skin healers can only do so much. If only he'd broken his spine, that'd be no trouble at all." Robert's laugh sounded hollow, a song without notes. The king was not yet dead, and already his consort was a shell of himself. And while she feared for her father-in-law, knowing that a painful, diseased death waited for him, she was terrified of losing Robert as well. "He cannot succumb to this. I won't let him." "It's fine. No need to explain," Corianne muttered. She did her best not to cry.
though every inch of her hoped to. How can this be happening? Are we not Silvers? Are we not gods? Does he need anything? Do you?
Robert smiled an empty smile. His eyes flashed to her stomach, not yet rounded by the life inside. A prince or princess, she did not know yet.
He would have liked to have seen that one.
House Skonos tried everything, even cycling the king's blood, but whatever sickness he had never disappeared. It wasted at him faster than they could heal. Usually Robert stayed by him in his chamber, but today he left Tiberius alone with his son, and Corianne knew why. The end was near. The crown would pass, and there were things only Tybe could know. The day the king died, Corianne marked the date and colored the entire diary page in black ink. She did the same a few months later, for Robert. His will was gone, his heart refusing to beat. Something ate at him, too, and in the end, it swallowed him whole. Nothing could be done. No one could hold him back from taking shadowed flight. Corianne wept bitterly as she inked the day of his ending in her diary. She carried on the tradition. Black pages for black deaths. One for Jessamine, her body simply too old to continue. One for her father, who found his end in the bottom of a glass. And three for the miscarriages she suffered over the years. Each one came at night, on the heels of a violent nightmare. Corianne was 21, and pregnant for a fourth time. She told no one, not even Tybe. She did not want the heartache for him. Most of all, she wanted no one to know. If Alara Mirandis was truly still plaguing her, turning her own body against her unborn children, she didn't want any kind of announcement regarding another royal child. The fears of a fragile queen were no basis for banishing a high house, let alone one as powerful as Mirandis. So Alara was still at court, the last of the three Queen's Trial favorites still unmarried. She made no overtures to Tybe. On the contrary, she regularly petitioned to join Corianne's ladies, and was regularly denied her request.
"It will be a surprise when I seek her out," Corianne thought, reviewing her meager but necessary plan. "She'll be off guard, startled enough for me to work." She had practiced on Julian, Sarah, even Tybe. Her abilities were better than ever. "I will succeed."
The parting ball signaling the end of the season at the Summer Palace was the perfect cover. So many guests, so many minds. Alara would be easy to get close to. She would not expect Queen Corianne to speak to her, let alone sing to her. But Corianne would do both. She made sure to dress for the occasion. Even now, with the wealth of the crown behind her, she felt out of place in her crimson and gold silks, a girl playing dress-up against the lords and ladies around her. Tybe whistled as he always did, calling her beautiful, assuring her she was the only woman for him, in this world or any other. Normally it calmed her, but now she was only nervous, focused on the task at hand. Everything moved both too slowly and too quickly for her taste. The meal, the dancing, greeting so many curled smiles and narrowed eyes. She was still the singer queen to so many, a woman who bewitched her way to the throne.
"If only that were true. If only I was what they thought me to be, then Alara would be of no consequence. I would not spend every night awake, afraid to sleep, afraid to dream."
Her opportunity came deep into the night, when the wine was running low and Tybe was in his precious whiskey. She swept away from his side, leaving Julian to attend to her drunken king. Even Sarah did not notice her queen steal away, to cross the path of Alara Mirandis as she idled by the balcony doors. "Come outside with me, won't you, Lady Alara?" Corianne said, her eyes wide and laser-focused on Alara's own. To anyone who might pass by, her voice sounded like music and a choir both, elegant, heartbreaking, dangerous. A weapon as devastating as her husband's flame. Alara's eyes did not waver, locked upon Corianne's, and the queen felt her heart flutter. "Focus," she told herself. Focus, damn you. If the Mirandis woman could not be charmed, then Corianne would be in for something worse than her nightmares. But slowly, sluggishly, Elara took a step back, never breaking eye contact.
Yes,
she said dully, pushing the balcony door open with one hand. They stepped out together, Corianne holding Elara by the shoulder, keeping her from wavering. Outside, the night was sticky hot, the last gasps of summer in the upper river valley. Corianne felt none of it. Elara's eyes were the only things in her mind.
"Have you been playing with my mind?" she asked, cutting directly to her intentions.
"Not for a while," Elara replied, her eyes far away.
"When was the last time?"
"Your wedding day."
Corianne blinked, startled. "So long ago."
"What? What did you do?"
"I made you trip." A dreamy smile crossed Alara's features.
"I made you trip on your dress."
That's it?"
"Yes."
"And the dreams? The nightmares?"
Elara said nothing. Because there's nothing for her to say, Corianne knew. She sucked in a breath, fighting the urge to cry. "These fears are my own. They always have been. They always will be. I was wrong before I came to court, and I'm still wrong long after."
"Go back inside," she finally hissed. "Remember none of this."
Then she turned away, breaking the eye contact she so desperately needed to keep Elara under her control. Like a person waking up, Elara blinked rapidly. She cast a single, confused glance at the queen before hurrying away, back into the party. Corianne moved in the opposite direction, toward the stone banister ringing the balcony. She leaned over it, trying to catch her breath, trying not to scream. Greenery stretched below her, a garden of fountains and stone more than 40 feet down. For a single, paralyzing second, she fought the urge to jump. The next day she took a guard into her service to defend her from any silver ability someone might use against her. If not Elara, then surely someone else of House Mirandis. Corianne simply could not believe how her mind seemed to spin out of control, happy one second and then distraught the next, bouncing between emotions like a kite in a gale. The guard was of House Arvin, the Silent House. His name was Rain, a savior clad in white, and he swore to defend his queen against all forces. They named the baby Tiberius, as was custom. Corianne didn't care for the name, but acquiesced at Tybe's request and his assurance that they would name the next after Julian. He was a fat baby, smiling early, laughing often, growing bigger by leaps and bounds. She nicknamed him Cal to distinguish him from his father and grandfather. It stuck. The boy was the sun in Corianne's sky. On hard days, he split the darkness. On good days, he lit the world. When Tybe went away to the front, for weeks at a time now that the war ran hot again, Cal kept her safe. Only a few months old and better than any shield in the kingdom. Julian doted on the boy, bringing him toys, reading to him. Cal was apt to break things apart and jam them back together incorrectly, to Corianne's delight. She spent long hours piecing his smashed gifts back together, amusing him as well as herself. "He'll be bigger than his father," Sarah said. Not only was she Corianne's chief lady-in-waiting, she was also her physician. "He's a strong boy." While any mother would revel in those words, Corianne feared them. Bigger than his father, a strong boy. She knew what that meant for a Kalor prince, an heir to the burning crown. "He will not be a soldier," she wrote in her newest diary. "I owe him that much. Too long the sons and daughters of House Kalor have been fighting. Too long has this country had a warrior king. Too long have we been at war, on the front and also within. It might be a crime to write such things, but I am a queen. I am the queen. I can say and write what I think." As the months passed, Corianne thought more and more of her childhood home. The estate was gone, demolished by the provost governors, emptied of her memories and ghosts. It was too close to the Lakelander border for proper Silvers to live, even though the fighting was contained to the bombed-out territories of the Choke. Even though few Silvers died, despite the Reds dying by the thousands. Conscripted from every corner of the kingdom, forced to serve and fight. My kingdom, Corianne knew. My husband signs every conscription renewal, never stopping the cycle, only complaining about the cramp in his hand. She watched her son on the floor, smiling with a single tooth, bashing a pair of wooden blocks together. He will not be the same, she told herself. The nightmares returned in earnest. This time they were of her baby grown, wearing armor, leading soldiers, sending them into a curtain of smoke. He followed and never returned. With dark circles beneath her eyes, she wrote what would become the second-to-last entry into her diary. The words seemed to be carved into the page. She had not slept in 3 days, unable to face another dream of her son dying. The Kalors are children of fire, as strong and destructive as their flame, but Cal will not be like the others before. Fire can destroy, fire can kill, but it can also create. Forest burned in the summer will be green by spring, better and stronger than before. Cal's flame will build and bring roots from the ashes of war. The guns will quiet, the smoke will clear, and the soldiers, red and silver both, will come home. 100 years of war, and my son will bring peace. He will not die fighting. He will not. He will not. Tybe was gone, at Fort Patriot in Harbor Bay. But Arvin stood just outside her door, his presence forming a bubble of relief. Nothing can touch me while he is here, she thought, smoothing the downy hair on Cal's head. The only person in my head is me. The nurse who came to collect the baby noticed the queen's agitated manner, her twitching hands, the glazed eyes, but said nothing. It was not her place. Another night came and went. No sleep. But one last entry in Corianne's diary. She had drawn flowers around each word. Magnolia blossoms. The only person in my head is me. Tybe is not the same. The crown has changed him, as you feared it would. The fire is in him, the fire that will burn all the world, and it is in your son, in the prince who will never change his blood and will never sit a throne. The only person in my head is me. The only person who has not changed is you. You are still the little girl in a dusty room, forgotten, unwanted, out of place. You are queen of everything, mother to a beautiful son, wife to a king who loves you, and still you cannot find it in yourself to smile. Still you make nothing. Still you are empty. The only person in your head is you. And she is no one of any importance. She is nothing. The next morning, a maid found her bridal crown broken on the floor, an explosion of pearls and twisted gold. There was silver on it, blood dark from the passing hours. And her bath water was black with it. The diary ended unfinished, unseen by any who deserved to read it. Only Alara saw its pages, and the slow unraveling of the woman inside. She destroyed the book, like she destroyed Corianne, and she dreamed of nothing.
Steel Scars, read by Jane Entwistle. The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Command clearance required. Day 61 of Operation Laker. Stage 3. Operative, Colonel Redacted. Designation, Ram. Origin, Soul Mary, LL. Destination, Command, at Redacted. Operation Laker completed ahead of schedule. Deemed successful. Canals and lock points of Lakes Pirius, Miskin, and Naren under control of the Scarlet Guard. Operatives Whipper and Optic will control Laker moving forward. Maintain close contact. Open channels to mobile base and command. stand and report protocol, awaiting action orders. Returning to trial with Lamb at present. Laker overview. Killed in action. D. Farron. T. Mills. M. Percher. 3. Wounded. Swifty. Wishbone. 2. Silver casualty count. 3. Green Warden. 1. Strong Arm. 1. Skin Healer. 1. Civilian casualty count. Unknown. Rise. Red as the dawn. Storms ahead. The colonel speaks to fill the silence. His one good eye presses to a crack in the compartment wall, fixing on the horizon. The other eye stares, though it can hardly see through a film of scarlet blood. Nothing new. His left eye has been like that for years. I follow his gaze, peering through slats in the rattling wood. Dark clouds gather a few miles off, trying to hide behind the forested hills. In the distance, thunder rolls. I pay it no mind. I only hope the storms don't slow the train down, forcing us to spend 1 second longer hidden here, beneath the false floor of a cargo car. We don't have time for thunderstorms or pointless conversation. I haven't slept in 2 days, and I have the face to prove it. I want nothing more than quiet and a few hours of rest before we make it back to the base in trial. Luckily, there's not much to do here but lie down. I'm too tall to stand in such a space, as is the colonel. We both have to sprawl, leaning as best we can in the dim partition. It'll be night soon, with only darkness to keep us company. I can't complain about the mode of transportation. On the trip out to Solmary, we spent half the journey on a barge shipping fruit. It stalled out on Lake Nerin, and most of the cargo rotted. Spent the first week of operations washing the stink from my clothes. And I'll never forget the mess before we started Laker, in Detreon. 3 days in a cattle car, only to find the Lakelander capital utterly beyond reach. Too close to the choke and the warfront to have shoddy defences. A truth I willingly overlooked. But I wasn't an officer then, and it wasn't my decision to try to infiltrate a silver capital without adequate intelligence or support. That was a colonel. Back then he was only a captain with the code name Ram and too much to prove. Too much to fight for. I only tagged along, barely more than an oathed soldier. I had things to prove too. He continues to squint at the landscape, not to look outside, but to avoid looking at me. Fine. I don't like looking at him either. Bad blood or not, we make a good team. Command knows it, we know it, and that's why we keep getting sent out together. Detreon was our only misstep in an endless march for the cause. And for them, for the Scarlet Guard, we put aside our differences each and every time. Any idea where we go next? Like the colonel, I won't abide the heavy silence. He pulls back from the wall, frowning, still not looking my way.
You know that's not how it works.
I spent 2 years as an officer, 2 more as an oathed soldier of the guard, and a lifetime living in its shadow. Of course I know how it works. I want to spit. No one knows more than they must. No one is told anything beyond their operation, their squadron, their immediate superiors. Information is more dangerous than any weapon we possess. We learned that early, after decades of failed uprisings, all laid low by one captured red in the hands of a silver whisper. Even the best trained soldier cannot resist an assault of the mind. They are always unraveled, their secrets always discovered. So my operatives and my soldiers answer to me, their captain. I answer to the colonel, and he answers to command, whoever they might be. We know only what we must to move forward. It's the only reason the guard has lasted this long, surviving where no other underground organization has before. But no system is perfect. Just because you haven't received new orders doesn't mean you don't have an idea as to what they might be, I say. A muscle in his cheek twitches. To pull a frown or a smile, I don't know, but I doubt it's the latter. The colonel doesn't smile. Not truly. Not for many years. I have my suspicions, he replies after a long moment. And they are? My own. I hiss through my teeth. Typical. And probably for the best, if I'm being honest with myself. I've had enough close shaves of my own with silver hunting dogs to know exactly how vital the guard's secrecy is. My mind alone contains names, dates, operations, enough information to cripple the last 2 years of work in the Lakelands. Captain Farley. We don't use our titles or names in official correspondence. I'm Lamb, according to anything that could be intercepted. Another defense. If any of our messages fall into the wrong hands, if the Silvers crack our ciphers, they'll have a hard time tracking us down and unraveling our vast, dedicated network. Colonel, I respond, and he finally looks at me. Regret flashes in his one good eye, still a familiar shade of blue. The rest of him has changed over the years. He's noticeably harder, a wiry mass of old muscle coiled like a snake beneath threadbare clothes. His blonde hair, lighter than mine, has begun to thin. There's white at the temples. I can't believe I never noticed it before. He's getting old. But not slow. Not stupid. The colonel is just as sharp and dangerous as ever. I keep still under his quiet, quick observation. Everything is a test with him. When he opens his mouth, I know I've passed.
What do you know about Norta?
I grin harshly.
So they finally decided to expand out. I asked you a question, little lamb.
The nickname is laughable. I'm almost 6 feet tall.
Another monarchy like the Lakelands, I spit out. Reds must work or conscript. They center on the coast. Their capital is Archeon. At war with the Lakelands for nearly a century. They have an alliance with Piedmont. Their king is Tiberius. Tiberius the...
The Sixth, he offers, chiding as a schoolteacher. Not that I spent much time in school. His fault.
Of the House Calor.
Stupid. They don't even have brains enough to give their children different names.
Burners, I add. They lay claim to the so-called Burning Crown. Fitting opposite to the Nymph Kings of the Lakelands. A monarchy I know all too well, from a lifetime living beneath their rule. They are as unending and unyielding as the waters of their kingdom.
Indeed. Opposite, but also horribly alike.
Then they should be just as easy to infiltrate. He raises an eyebrow, gesturing to the cramped space around us. He almost looks amused.
You call this easy?
I haven't been shot at today, so yes, I'd say so, I reply.
Besides, Norta is what, half the size of the Lakelands? With comparable populations, dense cities, a more advanced basis of infrastructure.
All the better for us. Crowds are easy to hide in. He grits his teeth, annoyed.
Do you have an answer to everything?
I'm good at what I do. Outside, the thunder rumbles again, closer than before.
So we go to Norta next. Do what we've done here, I press on. Already my body buzzes with anticipation. This is what I've been waiting for. The Lakelands are only one spoke of the wheel, one nation in a continent of many. A rebellion contained to its borders would eventually fail, stamped out by the other nations of the continent. But something bigger, a wave across two kingdoms, another foundation to explode beneath the Silver's cursed feet. That has a chance. And a chance is all I require to do what I must. The illegal gun at my hip has never felt so comforting.
You must not forget, Captain.
Now he's staring. I wish he wouldn't. He looks so much like her.
Where our skills truly lie. What we started as. What we came from.
Without warning, I slam my heel against the boards below us. He doesn't flinch. My anger is not a surprise.
How could I forget? I sneer.
I resist the urge to tug at the long blonde braid over my shoulder. My mirror reminds me every day. I never win arguments with the Colonel, but this feels like a draw at least. He looks away, back to the wall. The last bit of sunlight glints through, illuminating the blood of his wounded eye. It glows red in the dying light. His sigh is heavy with memory.
So does mine.
The following message has been decoded. Confidential. Command clearance required. Operative. Colonel. Redacted. Designation. RAM. Origin. Trial. LL. Destination. Command at redacted. Returned to trial with Lamb. Reports of LL Silver pushback in Adela verified. Request permission to dispatch Holiday and her team to observe, respond. Request permission to begin assessment of contact viability and NRT. Rise, red as the dawn. The following message has been decoded. Confidential, senior clearance required. Operative, general, redacted. Designation, drummer. Origin, redacted. Destination, RAM, at trial, LL. Permission to dispatch Holiday granted. Observe only. Eyes on operation. Permission to assess contact viability in NRT granted. Lamb will take point on Operation Red Web, making contact with smuggling and underground networks in NRT. Emphasis on the whistle black market ring. Orders enclosed. Her eyes only. Must dispatch to NRT within week. Ram will take point on Operation Shield Wall. Orders enclosed, your eyes only. Must dispatch to Ronto within week. Rise, red as the dawn.
Trial is the single largest city on the Latelander border. Its intricately carved walls and towers looking across Lake Redbone and deep into the heart of the Norton backcountry. The lake hides a flooded city, all raided and stripped by nymph divers. Meanwhile, the slave workers of the Latelands built Trial on the shores, in mockery of the drowned ruins in the Norton wilderness. I used to wonder what kinds of idiots are fighting this civil war, if they insist on containing the battlegrounds to the forsaken choke. The northern border is long and winding, cutting along the river, mostly forested on both sides. Always defended, but never attacked. Of course, in the winter, it's a brutal land of cold and snow. But what about the late spring and summer? Now. If Norta and the Latelands hadn't been fighting for a century, I would expect an assault on the city at any moment. But there's nothing at all, and never will be. Because the war is not a war at all. It's an extermination. Red soldiers conscript, fight, and die in the thousands, year after year. They're told to fight for their kings, to defend their country, their families, who would surely be overrun and overthrown if not for their forced bravery. And the Silvers sit back, moving their toy legions to and fro, trading blows that never seem to do much of anything. Reds are too small, too restricted, too uneducated to notice. It's sickening. Only one of a thousand reasons I believe in the cause and in the Scarlet Guard. But belief doesn't make it easy to take a bullet. Not like the last time I returned to Irabel, bleeding from the abdomen, unable to walk without the damned Colonel's aid. At least then I got a week to rest and heal. Now I doubt I'll be here much longer than a few days before they send us back out again. Irabel is the only proper guard base in the region, to my limited knowledge at least. Safe houses scatter along the river and deeper into the woods, but Irabel is certainly the beating heart of our organization.